This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Good afternoon. It is 5 minutes past one. Thank you, Matt Thompson, for the news. Today, we're on a cultural journey and looking at the impact of two things on our culture, something very old and something very new. I've got an historian talking to me and I have a winemaker talking to me. We're going to have a very interesting chat. Stick with me until 2 o'clock. Yes, we are talking cravings because we do this every Saturday. Good afternoon, Pete Dillon. It's 6 minutes past one, and today we are going on a cultural journey. We're talking history, and we're talking a red obsession. One of the things that I love in my life is a good glass of red wine. And so we're going to explore that with a winemaker and filmmaker, one and the same person. But first of all, we're going to look at... throughout the show, we're going to be looking at something called From Suet to Saffron. This is a story that... took my interest because it's charting the cultural history of the way that you and I eat, where we've come from and where we are now from a purely culinary perspective. This book was first printed in 1904, nearly as old as our president, David McCarthy. Never been out of print. And 108 years later, a young woman, an historian, has taken hold of this book. And she has built it into a wonderful story that does chart the cultural journey. She's in the studio, Fiona Bligh. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Pete. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Before we do that, I just wanted to remind people that they can be in touch with us, 0427-JOY-949. That's the number for an SMS, 0427-569-949. You can email on air at joy.org.au if you would like to email straight into the studio. You can phone 1300-JOY-949. I believe Heath is sitting on the front desk, ready for you to have a chat to. Or you can send us a tweet to cravings_joy949. Many, many ways to contact us and many, many ways for you to take part in this discussion today. We're looking at two things. Looking at a film as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival. And we're looking at this book called From Suet to Saffron. And Fiona Bligh, as I said, is my guest. Why did you decide, Fiona, to write this book?
Well, it's a little embarrassing, really. It didn't come from any particular great need to chart the history of cooking and eating, although I have to say I love both cooking and eating, don't you?
Yes. But anyone who's seen me knows that.
Well, the way it came about was I was visiting a friend of mine who worked in the PWMU office. We went out for a bite to eat, funnily enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I was up there waiting for her to get ready, and she said, "Oh, have a look at this box of books." And when I looked inside it, there were so many cookbooks, and there was the oldest PWMU cookbook, 1904, and the historian in me started twitching, and I just thought, I have to take a look at these.
Let's talk firstly about what the PWMU is. It's the Presbyterian Women's Missionary Union, which in 1904, I imagine, was some force.
Yes, it was. It was started in 1890 by a lot of really forward-thinking, formidable women. These were women that wanted to take part in what was going on in the world around them. One of the things that they did, Pete, was they actually trained and educated women to become doctors, nurses and teachers,
mm-hmm.
and to send them to remote parts of the globe to start schools, hospitals, orphanages. So a lot of fantastic work was done.
They were essentially missionaries.
That's exactly right.
To use the word. And so they've created this book in 1904 to what end? What was their purpose?
Well, they wanted to raise funds for the support of these women missionaries. And so what they wanted to do was they wanted to find a way of getting funds outside of their group. This is a time when a lot of women did not have control of their own purse strings. A lot of women would have been giving housekeeping allowances by their husbands. So they had to find a way to maximise the income.
Yep.
So they thought, okay, what can we do? And they were approached by a publisher who said to them, would you like to publish a cookbook? And this is in the context, Pete, of a lot of charity and organisational cookbooks that appear at this time.
Yeah.
And so they said, sure, why not?
So if we were to look at this cookbook and looking at versions from 1904, which I'm sure do exist.
Yes, they do.
They are not in our hot little hands at the minute. We are a very visual society now, and the tastes, our own culinary tastes, as compared to our grandparents, for example, you know, there's the 21st century taste bud is remarkably different to that of 1940s, 50s, 60s, and so forth. So what's been the biggest sort of surprise for you in putting this book together? You did mention just before we came on air about us being a visual society and how there's no images in this cookbook.
That's right. I think one of the most surprising things is that when we look at this cookbook, there aren't any pictures of any of the recipes at all. So anyone cooking from this recipe is actually really free. You're free to make it look however it looks, and that's a fantastic thing. But one of the big surprises looking back was that, yes, the majority of our cooking came from the British Isles, but they actually right from the beginning had the presence of other types of food in the book. So they had Indian curry, Indian fritters, they had Dresden patties, they had German toast, German cake, and they even had some French and Canadian recipes in there as well, which kind of sounds surprising, but if you think about the context, we're talking about a time when a lot of people had relatives overseas, and it was the height of colonialism, wasn't it? So you're going to get these influences.
If we look at if we're charting this over the decades, we'll see things like the availability of food, economic circumstances being different, increasing wealth, the changing of culture, the influences. You know, in the book in the 90s that was produced, it has a Thai green curry, whereas the thought of doing a curry in the 70s would have probably had sausages and Keane's curry powder in it. So
very much so. And some pineapple rings. Don't forget those, Pete. Got to have your pineapple rings in there.
Anybody who knows me and who has listened to this show knows that I am fiercely allergic to pineapple, and my mother used to cook with it all the time. My mother's idea of something exciting was to open a tin of crushed pineapple and put half a tin of crushed pineapple in anything. So 114 years later, as we go through the next hour, we're going to explore the 114-year history of this book, and it's the exploration around how women have remained for that 114 years at the forefront of food, regardless of the fact that most of our celebrity chefs are men, that most chefs in this day and age are men. It is interesting to watch and chart how this has taken us on a journey with women.
Very
for that
much
100,
so.
108
yes.
years. We'll come back to this book. It's called From Suet to Saffron. Its author is Fiona Bly. She is a Melbourne-based historian. She is the author of this book and has charted. We're going to talk a lot about it, but first we'll go to some messages and we'll come back and we'll have a chat to a fellow by the name of Warwick Ross. He moved here as a teenager from Hong Kong. He makes films and he makes wine. We're going to have a chat about one of his latest films that is part of the Melbourne International Film Festival. It's 13 minutes past one here on Cravings on Joy 94.9.
Hi, I'm Manny Fidel and you are with Pete Dillon on Cravings on Joy 94.9.
Yes, you are. Thank you, Manu, for popping in for that little announcement. You are with me here on Cravings on Joy 94.9, almost 18 minutes past one here on a reasonably sultry Melbourne afternoon. And today we're having a look at a cultural exploration of two things. Firstly, Fiona Bly, an historian, is in the studio with me. She's my guest talking about From Suet to Saffron. She's charted the history of a cookbook put together by the Presbyterian Women's Missionary Union back in 1904. And we're looking at its 180-year history and its charting of our cultural evolution when it comes to food. Fiona, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Not that we went anywhere. And joining us on the phone is somebody else who has had a fairly significant contribution to Australia's cultural history in a number of ways. The first of which was with a little film called Young Einstein in 1988, and a second film that he followed that up with called Reckless Kelly. this guest and his business partner have managed to become the most successful box office in Australian history with or film production company, I should say, with a theatrical box office of over $25 million. Interestingly enough, he also makes wine, and another nice little coincidence, you both graduated from the University of Melbourne. Warwick Ross, good afternoon.
Hi, Pete. How are you?
Good to talk to you, and I'll introduce you to Fiona across the airwaves.
Fiona, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
You both graduated from the same university. There you go. There's a little bit of kismet happening.
Shout out to Melbourne Uni.
Right, yes.
Correct. Warwick, you moved here from Hong Kong as a young fellow and graduated from the university with a degree in mechanical engineering. How do you move from that to making films that have changed our cultural perception?
Well, I think the filmmaker in me was always there. The mechanical engineer in me was never there. Made films at school, made films at university, and it was a natural segue onto film school in Los Angeles as soon as I'd got the degree under my belt.
Why did you choose mechanical engineering if you wanted to make films?
Because it was the sensible choice.
Of course it was. So you got together with a couple of other people and you made a little film called Young Einstein.
Right.
It remains one of the most popular Australian films ever released. Were you surprised at its success?
Yes, very much. I think all of us that were involved in that film, Yahoo Serious, myself, David Roach, and Yahoo's then wife Lulu Pincus, as she was, put that film together. And I think we thought we were making it for university students because that was about that was what we aspired to, having been brought up on things like Monty Python, Holy Grail, and all those films. We thought that was the audience we were going to, and in fact, they were the only ones that hated the film, and everybody else loved it from 6 to to 86 seemed to like it. So we lucked out.
And look, it was internationally ridiculously successful, number one at the French, German and UK box offices, as well as its success here. Went on to make, with the same team, another little film called Reckless Kelly.
Yes.
Again, number one at the Australian box office.
Yeah.
And, $25 million later, that's a fairly successful little run.
Yes, look, I think we were very lucky. We made those films at just the right time. The industry was looking for, crazy comedies, and I think we satisfied that desire. And then we sort of moved on. Yahoo then went away and started writing a Second World War film. I planted a vineyard, and David Roach went on to make other films himself, including a film called Beneath Hill 60, which was First World War. It was a heady time.
Great. Yeah. It sounds so. And look, you said you've planted a few vines. You actually have Portsea Estate wines on our very beautiful Mornington Peninsula down here.
Yeah, that's right.
And because you like international success, your Chardonnay and Pinot have both won international awards, if my sleuths tell me correctly.
Indeed, yes, that's right.
How do you move from making films to making wine, Warwick?
Oh, I think that goes hand in hand. There's something about the film industry and alcohol that just works so well together.
Indeed there are, which probably leads us very nicely to a film that you have as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival, something called Red Obsession. And this is an interesting look at Bordeaux as a wine style,
yeah,
and as a wine region, and its influence from a cultural perspective, I guess, around the world, particularly in new economies.
Yeah.
Talk us through the idea that you had to make this film.
Look, with most documentaries, you start to make the film you think you're making, and before long, you're making an entirely different film. You go where the leads take you, and we started by thinking we would make a film about Bordeaux and the beauty of it and the elegance of the wines and everything else. But within a very short space of time, we were picking up on this vibe that the prices of these Bordeaux wines had hit an all-time high, never higher in their history. And this was confounding because it was just after the global financial crisis and everything else in the world, including real estate, had all crashed. So we couldn't quite understand why these wines could command such incredibly high prices, particularly since we'd been told that the Americans no longer bought these wines and the French were still buying them, but to a lesser degree than they used to. The English had dropped out entirely. And then we discovered that it was this new voracious client, the Chinese, that had cropped up. And they were supporting these amazingly high prices that were felt at the time to be completely unsustainable. And actually, within the 12-month period that we filmed the film, that proved to be true. The prices were unsustainable and crashed, and Bordeaux suffered its largest crash since the global financial crisis. So it was a very interesting, dramatic arc that we followed through that time.
Fiona, I'm going to bring you in here as an historian, because I'm sure your ears are pricking up listening to this story. Bordeaux's been, you know, some of the great Bordeaux estates around the world. If we look at Chateau Neuf de Pape, Chateau Rothschild, you know, there's this wine has a remarkable history. And, you know, kings and emperors and dictators and all manner of people have been subject to its as a temptress almost.
Yes.
From an historian's perspective, is this an interesting thing you're listening to in charting this story of Bordeaux?
Look, I was wondering, are these Chinese investors, were they drinking the wine or were they investing on it to make money on it? What do you think?
Yes, that's a really interesting question, and we wondered the same thing. And what astounded us was that there were investors in these wines, and the wines that we're talking about retail for $2,000 a bottle. So, it's not for the faint of heart. But we
Nor
were
the
discovering
faint of pockets.
The people that were actually investing in these wines were the Westerners. So there are a few companies now in London that are set up very much like stock exchanges, and they buy and sell wines. And one of our interviewees even tells us that he'll get a call from a client who will throw $3 or $4 or $5 million down on the table and buy 25 cases of Chateau Lafite and 25 cases of Chateau Latour and sell them a few years later, and will never ever have seen the wine and don't even know what the bottle itself looks like.
Oh, as a wine drinker, I find that a little sad.
I find it gut-wrenchingly terrible.
And if you ask the Bordelais, they have pretty much the same sentiment that you've just expressed. They're sort of horrified by it, but of course it's supporting their industry.
Mm.
To answer your question on the Chinese side, what we discovered was that when the Chinese buy these expensive wines, they don't do that. They actually, because they have very much a gift-giving culture and a sharing culture, they will open these wines at dinner with their friends. So the wines were not being bought for investment. Almost always, they were being bought to share with friends. And it wouldn't almost matter how much they'd spent on the bottle if they presented that bottle to you during the course of the meal. It was to show you great respect, and that we found rather charming, even if they didn't quite understand what they were drinking in terms of the quality of the alcohol, the quality of the liquid, but that cultural expression we found very appealing.
Warwick, in historically, symbols of wealth have included, you know, motor vehicles, real estate, aeroplanes in some senses. And some of these Bordeaux that are ferociously expensive have almost become that new motif for power and wealth and influence. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, absolutely. And certainly in China, it's a symbol of what these people have achieved in China. It's very much a brand label. It's a badge that they wear. What was really fascinating for me, having been born in Hong Kong during a period where, China was just across the border and everybody was scared to death of it, was that the Chinese have now emerged from this period of, if you wanted to express it as darkness. 49, the communists took over. 79, the country was beginning to be opened up. But during that time, they were so effectively severed from their cultural ties and their cultural roots that a lot of the people we interviewed in China would say, when we came out of that period, we never looked back at our own cultural history. We looked at the things around the world, the things that we could never have had, but that we had heard so much about, whereas we weren't even allowed to talk about our own culture in a historical sense. So they naturally looked to the West. And what did the West have to offer? And what they had to offer in the very first instance were these brand names. So if you wanted to buy, a bag, and it was Hermes, it was Louis Vuitton, it was, all the big name brands that you recognize. And the wines of Bordeaux, particularly the top-end ones, Chateau Lafite, Rothschild, and Chateau Margaux, they fell straight into the brand name category.
Warwick, stick with us. We've got a lot more to discuss here. I've got to play a couple of messages and I'll be back with you. And I'll be back also with Fiona Bly, my guest, who is in the studio and a story and who I think is getting a very interesting take on this wine stuff. It's 28 minutes past one here on Joy 94.9.
Bonjour, I am Gabriel Gatte. You are listening to Cravings with Peter Dillon on Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Yes, you are listening to me. It's 1:30 here on a gloomy Saturday afternoon. It's 40 minutes away from the North Melbourne game at Etihad Stadium, where I think the blue and white will be victorious. And already happening at Ormond Hall is Game of Rhones, a wonderful exploration of Rhone wines, where I shall be heading post-program. In the studio, I have historian Fiona Bly. She's talking about From Suet to Saffron, her book exploring the 180-year history of the PWMU, the Presbyterian Women's Missionary Union Cookbook. We'll come back to Fiona very shortly. And on the phone, Warwick Ross, who is a filmmaker and a winemaker and mechanical engineer. A very interesting fellow, Warwick. Thanks for sticking with us, because I think Fiona and I were sort of, whilst those messages were playing, we sort of looked and went, it's interesting, we as Westerners are looking to the East for inspiration, particularly from a culinary perspective, and the East is looking to the West for status symbols. Is that a fair assumption to sort of restart this discussion?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's exactly what's happening in the world. And one of the questions we got asked time and time again was, the Chinese, they don't know anything about wine. And not only that, but wine doesn't go with their food in any way.
And, rubbish.
Yes. And we interviewed one person who was absolutely charming, who lives in Beijing. She's a wine educator. Her name is Fong Yi Walker, who said to us, well, it's a little bit like saying, you know, something does or doesn't go with European food. What do you mean by that? Are you talking about Swedish smorgasbord, or are you talking about Italian pasta?
Exactly.
And, the breadth of cuisines across China is quite astounding from south to north.
And look, I can attest, last night I ate some Chinese food in a Chinese restaurant in Chinatown right here in Melbourne. We had a beautiful art series Riesling from Lewin Estate with some entrees and with some tea smoked duck and a quite pungent chili crocodile-based dish. We had a bottle of red wine. It was beautiful.
Indeed, yeah.
Very beautiful. So back to this film, to The Red Obsession. This is a really wonderful exploration, I think, of the power of Bordeaux, and we wonder about this from a consumer's point of view. We wonder, you know, is this wine worth it? Why is this wine so iconic and so sought after?
Look, I think Bordeaux has been around for such a long time that it's seen revolutions and wars diseases like phylloxera, but it's always been considered the number one wine region in the world. If you go back 600 or 700 years, there are documents there that will show you that. It's also developed, of course, these iconic chateaus that make it so unbelievable to visit. It's like going to Disneyland if you drive through the Bordeaux countryside. So, all of those things.
And as you say, Chateau Lethif, Rothschild, Chateau Mouton, Chateau Margaux, and so forth and so on. These anyone who drinks a little bit of wine would be very familiar with these names, and they have had a very strong influence on the way that we even make wine here. You're making Pinot Noir down on the Mornington Peninsula at Portier Estates. Is it a French style you're making to follow the sort of the Grand Burgundies of France?
I think that in terms of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, no region really yet can match the great wines of Burgundy, and Australians are doing a damn good job of it. The Pinots and the Chardonnays that we're producing here now, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, I think have really come of age. And some of the Australian wines that I've been drinking recently in places, in all places around the world, but more recently up in Shanghai, where one of the comments of one of the particular Pinots we were drinking was that it was it could rival any of the current Burgundies, and I think that's testament to how far we've progressed in a very short space of time.
Warwick, one of the old adages they use is that imitation is the best form of flattery. Have you seen in China in your travels while you're making this film some of the rip-offs? For example, there was something that came across my desk that was called Ben Folds, which was a red wine being made out of China.
Yeah.
A direct rip-off of the name Penfolds. I would think the labels were very similar. Is that an indication that China in particular as a market is is coming of age in some senses, in the way that they are. They're actually producing some red wines now that are already being recognised or looked at by wine experts the world over.
Yes, indeed. In fact, there was an interesting case in point when we were filming. Most people, of course, the fakes in China are well known. The fakes, Chateau Lafite fakes, anecdotally, is now something like 9 out of 10 are fake, and even anecdotally, as many as 99 out of 100 are fake bottles in China. So nobody really trusts that brand anymore. But the Chinese are now producing their own wines, and one in particular, one. The Decanter World Wine Competition for Best Bordeaux Blend about two and a half years ago. And that rocked the wine world because no one thought Chinese wines could come anywhere near it. The interesting point there was that the winemaker or the wine consultant for that particular vineyard worked at Chateau Palmer in Bordeaux and picked up all his expertise there, brought it back to China and applied his skills. Now, when the wine won the award, there was an awful lot of scuttlebutt and rumour that this wine couldn't possibly be a Chinese wine. It must have been a real Bordeaux that they'd smuggled back to China, rebadged, relabeled, put into a Chinese bottle, and then brought back to the competition, in some sense as being a reverse fake, if you like. But the Chinese are just beginning to make wines that will impact the world, and we'll find that they'll impact more and more as time goes on.
And Warwick, I think the economic circumstances in China as a rising economic power, as a risen economic power, we're going to see more and more money invested into wine and things like wine because of its influence on the rest of the world.
Yes, particularly with the Chinese government now. They're trying to pull their population away from high alcohol drinks. So their baijiu's and maotais and things like that, which are traditionally very high in alcohol, and also use up a lot of the arable land because they're grain-based alcohols. The arable land, the Chinese government feels, very much needs to be set aside for food and not for alcohol.
Mm.
So they're swinging across into vines because, as a lot of people will know, you can plant a vine on almost any soil, so long as it's free draining and you can get some water to it, and the vines will grow. They're almost like weeds. So if you go out to the Gobi Desert regions, as we did during the course of this film, they're planting tens of thousands of acres out there right now to satisfy what they see will be the future Chinese demand. So something like 20 or 30,000 acres per year are being planted, and it's by far the largest planting country in the world right now.
It's extraordinary. Red Obsession screens as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival next Saturday the 3rd and following Monday the 5th of August. You can find out more about it and, of course, get your tickets at www.mif.com.au. Warwick Ross, thank you for your time this afternoon.
My pleasure, Pete.
Really grateful to have you. That's Warwick Ross. He is a vigneron. He's a filmmaker. He has had his own significant impact on Australia's culture over the last, 25 or 30 years. Really grateful to have him with us. Thank you, Warwick. Fiona, what an interesting story. And I'm sure the historian part of you is sitting there twitching, going, I could explore more of this.
Isn't it interesting, too, about the reach of food and wine across the globe? I mean, the thought that the Chinese are going to be one of the biggest wine producers. Now, if you'd said that to someone 100 years ago,
they'd have punched you in the head and
been
stupid.
They wouldn't have known what to make of it. That's right.
Well, it's interesting you talk about 100 years ago. 100 years ago, if you had said to the Presbyterian Women's Missionary Union that you're coming to talk about their cookbook on Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station, there would have been quite a few raised eyebrows back then, I should think.
Absolutely. I think they, first of all, would have wondered what radio was for a start. But basically, yeah, I think it's a fantastic opportunity and I'm really grateful that I can come and talk to you and your listeners.
Very good. Now, if you are interested in that film, Red Obsession, it's playing as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival. Also playing as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival is another film that tells a wonderful historical story. It's called Siparo Italiano, Lygon Street. It's the story of our most iconic food-eating street. After the disaster of World War II, there was a wave of Italian immigrants. They found their way to Melbourne, which they thought was a really strange place and, you know, suspicious of both outsiders and completely devoid of a good cup of coffee. They congregated in a little rundown stretch of Carlton known as Lygon Street. irrepressible restaurateurs, entrepreneurs, and sometimes the mafiosi would come to define not only a street but an entire city, a city that loves its food, and very much Ligon Street is a part of that. It's a film made by Shannon Swan and Angelo Pricolo, both of who are guests of the festival, and you can catch up with them as well. It combines some archival footage, some one-on-one interviews, and a roundtable of Ligon Street's most prominent figures. This film also screens Saturday 3rd of August and Thursday 8th of August as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival. Go to miff.com.au to find out some more and explore those two films that look at our drinking history and our eating history, certainly when it comes to Italian food. And I'm reckoning, Fiona, by the look in your eyes, you'll be at least one of those screenings.
Definitely. I have to say I've got a very, very soft spot for Ligon Street in my heart because I was taken there as a kid, like lots of Melbourne kids, to go and eat pizza at Toto's. Do you remember Toto's?
Oh, I do remember Toto's. I actually worked in Ligon Street 100 years ago when I was back in my chefing days. We used to go there after work and eat as well. It was actually Faraday Street. I was off Ligon Street, but we'd walk around to Ligon Street. We'd get a glass of wine at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, Toto's was renowned for being open very late. I waitressed there in the 80s.
Wow.
And, oh, one of the most wonderful experiences was working the giant Italian weddings. I just used to love it.
Incredible.
Yeah, just the zest for life. Absolutely amazing. So I really enjoyed that.
We're going to have a couple of more messages. We're going to have a listen to another piece of music, this one from the 80s, because we're talking Red Obsession and an obsession with food. It's called, oddly enough, Obsession. It's 19 minutes to 2 here on Cravings on Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
G'day, I'm Pete Evans, and you are with Pete Dillon on Cravings on Joy 94.9.
Yes, you are. It's 14 minutes to 2 here on Cravings on Joy 94.9. That track, of course, was Obsession. Now, anybody who grew up in the 80s, Fiona and I, have been busting out our very favourite 80s moves by a mob called Animotion. One-hit wonders from the 80s, Fiona.
Oh, look, I've actually got the 80s rock box in my car, Pete. I've got five CDs of 80s one-hit wonders. I'm educating my children, and every time they hear a song on a movie now... Because, you know, all these animated movies, that's where they're getting their music. It's everyone in our generation.
We were in the car. My partner and I share custody of two children, and we have a six-year-old, and we were in the car heading to the country, and there was a soundtrack. I think I had my iPod on, and one of the tracks in one of my playlists is We Built This City by Starship.
Yeah. Absolute golden oldie favourite.
A movie called Mannequin.
Yes, I remember Mannequin because Kim Cattrall was in it. Do you remember?
Yes, she was with Matthew Broderick.
No, Andrew McCarthy.
Andrew McCarthy,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, very much so. So history, Mannequin, history. I remember that.
And we're driving along, partner and I, you know, having a bit of... And there's this voice coming from the back, and it's Little Miss Six, and she's singing her head off to this song. Because it had been in an animated movie that she had
seen.
Totally.
And in fact, my kids like telling their mates at school, you know, oh, you know that song in Tangled, or you know that song in Finding Nemo, whatever. Yeah, that's from the 80s.
It's from the 80s. It's old because
all
my parents listened to it. We are having an exploration here today of cultural influences. We've talked Red Obsession, a film as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival. What we started our discussion with and what we shall finish with, Fiona Bly, is this book from Suet to Saffron, The History of the PWMU Cookbook in Victoria. I will remind people, the Presbyterian Women's Missionary Union, a bunch of very resourceful women who... in 1904 had the good idea to put a cookbook together to raise a bit of money to continue their work in bringing their message to the developing world, I should think.
Yeah, very much so. They had a presence in Korea, for example, and Vanuatu, places like that. A lot of those institutions are still going today, and you know, schools, orphanages, particularly training girls as well.
How much of this book do you think is, as much as it is a discussion and a look at... food in the last 108 years and the changing influences in the way that Australians have eaten, how much of it is about how women have become more a part of society? The evolution of women as equal citizens, I guess, is probably
where
I'm
going.
Yeah,
very much so. Look, the birth of this book takes place at the early 20th century, so you're talking the suffragette movement. You're talking about this idea that women can have an equal place in our culture. Mm. And that in itself was a radical thing. And these women obviously were part of that because they actually wanted to have ownership of the funds and make decisions about where the funds went. So, yes, it's very much part of that, but it's also part of women moving moving from a predominantly domestic sphere mm-hmm. of life,
yep.
where the care of your family was your major focus, to moving outward from that. And you see that in this book. So you see things, for example, in the 50s, you see the influence of the pressure cooker coming in. Mm. And one of the things the book talks about is the businesswoman who has to prepare her own meal of an evening yes. may benefit from a pressure cooker, you see, Pete, because she it takes you 3 minutes to make something as opposed to, you know, an hour.
Not if you grew up in my household with the world's worst cook. I guess it also, if we look at back in 1904, that very early part of the 20th century, where women were married and running households at 17 and 18 and 19 years of age. These days it's 27 through 30 odd years of age. And so this book would have been for those women pre-World War One, for example, a wonderful resource when setting up a home.
Very much so. So originally, actually, one of their biggest aims was to make it a book that would teach people, teach young women. And they were also very mindful of the fact they had a lot of rural members. There were literally thousands of women in this group across Victoria. So they would have known women who were marrying at 17, 18, 19 and potentially being isolated, being on farms, being on properties and having to suddenly run a kitchen. And some of these women, Pete, would be cooking or overseeing the cooking for musterers and shearers. Mm. So they needed to have bulk recipes. They also needed to have an idea of how to feed a lot of hungry people.
Yep.
So,
and look, there's wonderful wonderful examples in here. Some quirky advice from 1916. As an article of diet, fish is inferior to lean meat. It is less stimulating and less nourishing. Provided as a chief dish for dinner, it should be followed by a substantial pudding, as fish is lacking heat and energy-producing constituents.
Yes, it's fascinating, isn't it?
It's extraordinary.
They actually put nutritional advice in. Mm. You'll be unsurprised to hear that a lot of that nutritional advice has been superseded. And
sort
we have
kinda.
A bit of a better idea of some of the nutritional value of foods. But that was part of their idea too, Pete, that they felt that you could actually increase the health of your family, protect the health of your family if you had some idea about nutrition. And they also thought that you could be smart about it with your money. And there's a little bit in one of the books where it says that, you know, just because you might be cooking on a budget, it doesn't mean your family has to lose out, because if you've got the knowledge we have, we can help you be economical but also present a fantastic array of food.
Mm. I was particularly taken through the 70s. There was one of the books was released, I think, in 1973.
That's right, the metric edition.
The very first metric edition, and some of the very popular recipes from that era was a salmon mornay, using tinned salmon, not fresh salmon, of course, chicken Maryland, which, if people don't know, is basically the thigh and the leg of the chicken. It was cooked in a particular manner and called Chicken Maryland, where it's now. That's the cut of the meat. Beef stroganoff, sweet and sour beef, angels and devils on horseback, which is oysters, and they were generally tinned oysters because we weren't farming oysters at that stage, in bacon and prunes in bacon. Chow mein or kai si min, which every household had a version of.
I don't think it was particularly Chinese, do you?
No, ours was made of minced meat, chicken noodle soup, rice, a cabbage, maybe a half a teaspoon of Keen's curry powder, and quite possibly the aforementioned half a tin of crushed pineapple.
You know, that whole chicken noodle soup thing, Pete, that's a bit of a meme in the book from the 60s onwards. You would be amazed how many Chinese recipes actually have chicken noodle soup as one of their main ingredients.
Which was basically just salt, MSG, and some very small, you know, it was the precursor to today's, you know, Maggi two-minute noodle.
Very much so. But people loved cooking out of cans in the 60s and 70s.
Well, I guess that's another part of the cultural difference, because we weren't familiar. I mean, we have so many microclimates, and we are so blessed to live in a country that produces so much of its own food. We should rely a lot less on imported food. So tomatoes didn't come in cans.
That's right. People actually grew a lot of food themselves. One of the things you see in this book is you see the movement actually culturally, where a lot of people would have fruit trees. Mm. In the early books, they had so many recipes for quinces. And gardens. And chickens. And some people actually not only had chickens for eggs, but they had chickens for eating. Mm, so you needed to know how to actually butcher a fowl, and you needed to know how to prepare it and also how to keep it and store it. So all of that was in the original editions. Now, I don't know about you, Pete, but I haven't killed a chicken in a long time.
Since my childhood, my father used to lop the heads off chickens. They would run around and bleed for a period of time before he would hang them upside down from the apricot tree.
Oh, but we're not traumatised.
Absolutely not. I did spend a number of years of my life as a vegetarian for that very reason.
Well, there's dishes for you in the PWMU cookbook in 1916. How do you feel about, as an ex-vegetarian, what if I served you a dish of peanut cutlets, Pete? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take these peanuts, I'm going to shell them, I'm going to cook them, I'm going to crush them, then I'm going to shape them into a nice little cutlet shape, and then I'm going to get a piece of macaroni and put that on as the bone. I'm going to dish that up to you and say, happy vegetarian eating, but don't feel like you're missing out, Pete, because at least it looks like a cutlet.
Yeah, probably not. My mother used to make something called mock chicken.
Yes. Do you know there were actually mock recipes in these books as well? So this came about from not having the right ingredients or not having the money to buy the right ingredients.
Mock liver.
Mock turtle soup.
Yes, yeah. Look, we could explore these recipes. There's actually a CWA cookbook that I got hold of from the 1950s who had a lot of those recipes.
Yes, it was very
popular.
And some of this came out of rationing, Pete, because from 1942 onwards, there was a rationing of some basic foods in Australia during the war. So these mock recipes were always popular.
Well, our mock chicken consisted of some curdled scrambled egg.
Making me hungry, Pete.
Italian
careful.
Mixed herbs, a bit of diced tomato.
Now, those would be mixed herbs in a jar,
right? Dried McCormick stuff. That had probably sat in the cupboard for a year and a half because we weren't familiar at that time with the thought of things going past their expiry date.
That's right. And also, too, one of the things that's interesting is you see this idea in the original books of freshness being super important. Mm. So freshness was really important and prized because they didn't have refrigeration.
No.
But then suddenly by the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the change in actually how we manufacture food and process it, suddenly, before we know it, people aren't prizing freshness as much as, well, I won't say staleness, but they were actually prizing the ability to keep and store a lot of food at home. And I wonder if some of that might have come because people in the 50s and the 60s may have grown up in the Depression and remembered what it was like not to necessarily have enough food.
Well, I also would question the Industrial Revolution and how we all of a sudden had canneries and we could preserve food. You know, I've seen whole chickens in cans.
That's right.
Disturbing stuff. And we started to produce that stuff. So... And there were things being bottled and all of those ideas of preserving one's fruit from a particular season.
That's right.
The stone fruits from
That's
summer
right.
got preserved and eaten with ice cream or whatever in winter.
And would have made the ice cream yourself because in the 50s too, suddenly with refrigeration, a lot of people made ice cream, homemade ice cream, and those recipes were in the books as well.
Fiona, it's a wonderful exploration of not just the PWMU but also the way that Australians have eaten over now 11 and going into 12 decades. I understand that the 2013 book is...
Yes, it's being launched in December. So
launched in December.
Think about Christmas gifts out there, listeners.
And it's reasonably cheap.
Yeah, it's $25, which is pretty good. When you consider going out and getting a nice glossy Nigella, you're looking at $50, aren't you?
And the rest. Yes. So From Suet to Saffron is the story of this wonderful cookbook from first published in 1904. It's still being published now in 2013. So 105, 109 years later, 110 years later. Originally planned as a resource for the home, it is the book that charts the 100-year history and thereabouts of Australian women and the influences that changed our lives from the early 1900s right up until now. Fiona, thank you so much for coming and joining me today. It's been a joy to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Pete. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. I will be back next week, of course, with another episode of Cravings, and Lord knows what we're going to explore. A couple of messages, and we'll be back to say farewell. This is Cravings here on Joy 94.9. It's 3 minutes to two.
Joy.
I'm off to drink some plonk at the Game of Thrones. I'm imploring you to stay tuned for at least another hour and as Mark and Joe take you on a journey somewhere around the world on the Escape Pod. Thank you to my guests. Thank you to the team on the front desk. Thank you to Maddie T for the news. Have a very, very good afternoon. I shall be back next week. Goodbye.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.